Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Wonder Podcast, the podcast where we break down and review movies all in one big, long, unbroken take. I'm Austin Archer, and with me, as always, is my childhood next-door neighbor and lifelong best friend,
Kramer England.
Kramer, what's
Austin?
Up?
Not much. How about you?
Oh, my back. I'm old, and I hurt my back playing sports. I tried to be a sports guy. I'm even wearing a shirt that says "Go Sports," and
you know what? At least you did it playing sports. A couple years ago, I just fell on the ground, like fell on my butt. And then the next day I couldn't move. So at least you were doing something cool. I just fell.
But also, like, I wish I would have gotten hurt, like, on a really cool play. Yeah. Like, if like diving for a catch or something. I was stretching my hamstring in between events and my back just popped and went out. And I, like, literally couldn't walk the rest of the night.
It's so, you know, it's so weird how fragile we are. And this is even, okay, when I worked at the U, you remember Zach Moss?
Mm-hmm.
Zach Moss, one of the best Utah running backs. He was getting into his bed and he pulled a muscle. And that was it. And the trainers were like, yeah, it happens. Like, it's weird, but like, he wasn't doing anything. He just was getting into his bed and he pulled something. It's crazy what little things can do.
Well, I kept joking all weekend long that, like, anytime I'm watching professional sports and there's someone who's my age, our age, that's playing, the announcers are like, it's amazing that he's still performing at this level at his age. You know, LeBron James is 40 years old and he's having an unbelievable season. But the thing about LeBron James and, like, you know, Mike Conley and these guys is they are world-class athletes who get paid millions of dollars to be professionally in shape. And they have a team of trainers that work on their bodies every single day. And people are still impressed that they're doing what they're doing. And I went and did, like, this 3-day long sports extravaganza with a bunch of out of shape white guys. And like, why do we think we can just show up and be like, ah, I bet if I do a few shoulder rolls,
I'm good.
If I do a few of these, I'll be good to go. You know.
That's how we men are. You know, we just think that we'll be fine because we see other guys do it. We can do it. Why not?
Yeah, it's like announcers talk about it like it's a medical miracle when there's a professional athlete doing it. You know. And
It still is pretty amazing with it. Like, I look at Tom Brady and I'm like, seriously, dude, how did you do that? I can't do that.
The season LeBron James is having right now is blowing my mind. Like, I think he could win MVP this year, which is crazy. But and he's 40 years old. But we're not talking about sports. This is not a sports podcast. No. Gene Hackman, RIP, has left us. A legend. A true acting legend. One of these guys who got into the game late. Like, he got his first big roles later in life. And then he got out of the game early.
Yeah,
like he really did like a 30-year-ish, like a 35-year run, and then he just said peace, and he went and he was retired for like the last 20 years of his life, and he was just like going to a gas station every day getting gas station coffee.
And is that what he was doing?
Yeah, there are like all these like photos of him as like a 90-year-old man, like just kind of outside of like a Chevron with like gas station coffee and like a he doesn't look at all like a guy who's a movie star. He just looks
His last movie was in 2004 and it was Welcome to Mooseport.
And his first big role was Popeye Doyle in The French Connection. So it's about a 33-year career because that movie was 1971.
Yep.
And it's also a damn shame that his last movie was Welcome to Mooseport.
Yeah, just, you know, I saw that movie and I liked it, but I didn't really pay much attention to it thinking this would be his. I mean, he was really good. He was good in everything, even if it wasn't a good movie, which Welcome to Mooseport wasn't anything amazing, but it was, you know, it was fine. But yeah, too bad that he ended on that one.
He's one of the all-time greats. You know, some of my favorites. I love him in The Replacements. I love that movie.
Yes, he is good.
I love him in Behind Enemy Lines. I love, you know, Crimson Tide.
Enemy of the State. He's Enemy really good State. In that.
He
won for Unforgiven.
Unforgiven.
That's a movie I need to see again. Because that movie, the end of that movie was crazy amazing.
Maybe we should do it because I've never seen it.
Oh, so it's really good. Yeah.
Maybe we should do it on a future episode.
We probably should.
Stay tuned. He's great in Young Frankenstein.
Yeah. Oh yeah. What is he in Young Frankenstein?
He's got that scene where he's the blind guy and the monster comes to.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
And he's like, come sit down, friend. Come. Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't he keep like hurting him?
Yeah. He like lights him on fire accidentally. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We gotta watch that movie again. Yeah. He had range because he can play these serious characters and then these funny, really weird, silly characters.
Yeah.
And he was a great actor.
Absolutely. And what we decided to do was neither one of us had ever seen The French Connection. And we said, let's watch The French Connection. This is a very famous movie. This is a movie that in many ways feels like it kind of kicked off the era of 70s cinema, this change that was happening in cinema where things were getting more gritty and realistic. And, you know, the camera was kind of more loose and it sort of felt like almost like the birth of indie cinema was in the 70s. Like everything before that was in the studio system in the 70s. Really felt like young film students who were running and gunning through cities with like handheld cameras and stuff. So we decided to watch The French Connection and long story short, we'll talk about it a little bit, but both of us kind of got on the phone and we were like, what'd you think about that movie?
Yeah, this is definitely the French Connection is definitely a movie that I appreciate. Mm-hmm. And you appreciate as well. Mm-hmm. Like you cannot deny. And the car chase scene at the end of the movie is still filled with tension. Really, really good. Really well shot. But it's just a movie that I just didn't really like.
I watched it with my dad and my dad hadn't seen it in years and he was excited to show it to me. He was like, oh, you've never seen The French Connection? And I go, no. And he's like, oh yeah, let's sit down and watch it. Cause I'm at my parents' house right now in Sandy. And we sat down and watched it. My dad slept through most of it. And then the credits roll and he looks at me and he's like, so what'd you think of that? And I go, I don't know. What'd you think? And he goes, I think we've gotten better at making movies. And I go, yeah, I think so too. I think
it's such a good sum up. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, no shade to William Friedkin.
No,
you know, I mean, that's
we owe a lot to this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But and the first is usually not the best.
Yeah. And I do think that famous car chase scene is a very impressive set piece, especially for 1971 and especially for how run and gun and indie this film feels, that this film feels like it feels like they did that. And I don't know if there might be stories about them doing it without permits. Cause like it feels, it feels so like real and, you know, and it's an impressive little set piece, but the movie itself, I just kind of was like, it got to the end of it. And I was like, I never at any point cared about anything that was happening in that movie. I didn't care about any of the characters. I think Popeye Doyle is a terrible person. I know he's supposed to be. I know I can already feel the film bros in our comments being like, you guys misunderstood. And it's like, no, I get it. He's supposed to be like an anti-hero. But I just was like, there's nothing about his character that I could latch onto and root for in any way. Yeah. I don't even know what Roy Scheider is doing in the film. It seems like he's just there. And there was like nothing to his character. And then also I just had a hard time. Like by the end of the film, I was like, I don't know if it's heroin or cocaine that we're busting these guys for. I don't
know. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, let me ask you, did your screening have subtitles when they spoke in French?
I think I had to turn them on.
Yeah. Cause it didn't have subtitles when they spoke in French. And I was like, well, how am I supposed to know what's going on in these scenes?
I've had that lately. There's been a few movies that don't have subtitles and I've had to turn it on, which is weird. It's totally bizarre to me, but no, actually it did. It had it written out.
Oh,
so that's weird that yours did not have that.
Yeah. I was like, and there were like whole scenes where like,
there's a lot of exposition. So,
I was looking at my dad who speaks French and I was like, did you catch any of that? And he was like, oh yeah, some of it. They were saying like the drop is on Tuesday at like a hotel. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. It's weird. What did you watch it on?
We like just found it, you know, like on demand or something. And we just rented it.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's weird. It's weird. This is the thing though about 70s movies.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to be the birth of like our own American new wave. Cause it's like this movie is so much modeled after the French new wave of doing things completely differently, right? Mm-hmm. Like the French were like, we don't have to, like, early in the movie, early in cinema, you'd have to have a person, if they were going to a building, you'd have to show them walk into the building. You have to show them getting in the elevator, going upstairs, and then going and seeing the receptionist, and then going into the office. Yeah. Like, you had to do that section of events. And then the French came along and were like, we don't have to do that. Why would we do that? And they totally changed cinema in a lot of good ways. It just made it basically like they brought in montage, which is like people will fill in the gaps. Yeah. And obviously there's way more to it than that, but it took the Americans a while to catch on. And I think this really took heavily from the French New Wave. And so they don't explain a lot. Like I felt the exact same way as you. That, like, I'm like, what is going on? Like, what is happening? And like, I was piecing things together, but it's like really hard to follow these movies because they give you so little exposition that you have to fill it in yourself, which a lot of people like. And I like that to an extent as well. But on this one, it was just so, like, so little that I'm like, it was hard for me to keep up. I felt like I was missing something. Did you feel the same way?
Totally. I felt like there were scenes missing, especially the ending. Like the movie has a very strange ending.
Very,
like,
70s. Yeah.
And very 70s, but it's an ending that I was like, I get that this is supposed to leave me feeling unfulfilled and kind of conflicted in some way. And I know that, like, the whole end sequence is supposed to kind of be like, Popeye is just, he doesn't really care about the fact that there's collateral damage, that one of the federal agents was just killed. But it's also like the movie just ends, like he kills a federal agent, and then he runs after the other guy that you hear shots. You don't know what that means.
Yeah.
You don't know if he shot the other guy or not, but the movie just ends and it's like, okay, all right. Yeah. And it is very 70s. And I do feel like, it felt like it was the beginning of something that they were figuring out.
Yeah.
And so you can give them a lot of credit. And there's definitely, like, Gene Hackman, you can see why he became a movie star for this film. Cause he's definitely, like, given it a lot.
He plays the character very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I agree with you, like, I didn't really like him. It was hard to root for him because but he played the character very well. It won Best Picture. He won Best Actor. It won a ton of awards. Yeah. Again, I appreciate the film, but I didn't love it.
Yeah. So what we decided instead, we watched The French Connection, you know, to the beginning of Gene Hackman's storied career. What we decided instead is, in order to honor this legend, we really wanted to watch something that is one of his truly great films. And we decided to watch maybe my all-time favorite film. Usually when people ask me what my favorite movie is, I go, I don't know, but if I had to pick one, it's probably The Royal Tenenbaums. And we decided to watch The Royal Tenenbaums.
Yep.
And it's, you know, I don't know, this is maybe the 100th time I've seen this movie in my life. And I still contend that it is a perfect film, and that, you know, but let's, so that's what we watched. This movie is huge for me. What's your experience like coming back to The Royal Tenenbaums?
It's funny. I watched this 2 years ago and I remember just being like, I didn't like it as much as I remembered. And I don't know what it was. Like, I think 2 years ago I was either, it wasn't the right mood or just wasn't the right night, whatever. Just like, you know, sometimes when you watch a movie, you have different experiences.
Sure.
And on this one, I kind of fell in love with it again. I think just like looking at it more critically and looking at it, kind of trying to find the themes and all the, you know, all the different structure and everything in it. And I like, even back then, it's not that I hated the movie. I still love this movie. And I still watching it this time, I'm just amazed at Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
He sees the world in such a different way than I do.
Yeah.
And I love, like, I could never have thought of this, even anything similar to this movie. And I love the way that him and Owen Wilson, they wrote this movie together.
Yeah.
And the way that it's like, this is such an amazing way to view a story. And he does this with everything. And I mean, this is really when he really, like, Wes Anderson, this put Wes Anderson on the map, especially with his framing and everything that he does, his production design, all of that. It really set him apart.
Yeah, we talk about runs a lot on this show. We talk about, like, you know, like the run that Christopher Nolan went on when he was making The Prestige and like that, like, you know, and like filmmakers that have these little periods where it's like there's like this five film or four film run. You know, when we did Signs, like Shyamalan went on a little run just kind of kickstart his career. And then, you know, maybe like it halted with like Lady in the Water or something like
that.
You
know? Right. Yeah. But
differ on where they think that ended. This team, the Wilson brothers and Wes Anderson, who all met at film school and started making like indie films together, they came out of the gate. They were complete outsiders, Hollywood outsiders, and they came out of the gates with a five movie run that I think is what it's like my favorite five movie run of any filmmaker. And it's Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and The Darjeeling Limited. Mm-hmm. And those five movies are just like, to me, about as close to perfect as you can get with a five. And it, like, to announce the way that Wes Anderson announced himself with each successive film. Cause Bottle Rocket is like, it's like the least Wes Anderson-y of all the Wes Anderson, which is why a lot of people love it the most, because it feels the most like him trying to figure his voice out. But I'm like, I love Bottle Rocket, but Rushmore is where it's the next movie where after Bottle Rocket, they got funding and they got to, like, you know, get Bill Murray on board and stuff like that. Rushmore is the movie where it's like, okay, now this is what this guy's capable of with a studio backing him and with a little bit of a budget. Then The Royal Tenenbaums to me is like, and here's the masterpiece. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like this bump set spike. And you're right. The world building here is crazy. It's the way that they create this like other New York City that is, you know, they have all these little references, like, you know, that Chaz was selling mice to a pet shop in Little Tokyo. And Little Tokyo is not a thing. There's Chinatown. They have like the Gypsy Cab Company, you know, not a real, like, but like they have these, like, these little idiosyncrasies to their version of New York City that, but it all lives inside of this. It's like a live action cartoon where everyone has like costumes that they wear, kind of like if you're watching The Simpsons or Family Guy or something, like the characters all wear the same costume every day.
That's so true. Yeah.
Not only do the Tenenbaum children wear their clothes, their costumes as kids, when they grow up as adults, they wear the same costume. Yeah. They wear their like character costume the entire movie. And it's such a little idiosyncrasy. And even like Eli Cash as a boy, when they're little boys and they're playing with BB guns, he's got his face painted with war paint. And then when he's older, he's like really into, like, you know, like cowboys and Indians. Like that's like Eli Cash's big thing. And everyone kind of has the same, like Ethelene's always wearing a dress with like a blazer, you know, and then Royal's got his pinstripe suits, but the pastel shirt changes underneath the pinstripe suit. Yeah. But that's his costume. And I love like Danny Glover's costume, which is like the blue blazer with the different colors of checked shirts underneath and different colorful bow ties. And
it's just
incredibly vivid. Yeah.
Yeah. I love Danny Glover, and it is, I mean, it really, it's his style. And this, his style really, really came out in this one. And you either, I think most people know that Wes Anderson is different. Even if you're not a movie person, you watch this movie and you're like, why is this movie so weird? I feel like more people like this than don't. It definitely can get a little, like, he's gotten to the point where his movies are so similar that it's like, okay, let's see something different. Movie, I think, is like a heist movie. And I think more mainstream. It's either a heist movie or I don't know. It sounds like it's going to be more mainstream, which I'm really, really excited for, because I want to see him kind of step out of his comfort zone that he does so well, which I love. It's not that it's bad, but I find it interesting to see. I'm really interested to see what he's going to do. But this movie, Royal Tenenbaums, is really where everybody noticed it. Like when this movie came out, it was, everybody talked about it.
Yeah. I think that this sort of like I said, Rushmore is definitely, it's very much so a Wes Anderson movie, as is Bottle Rocket, but it's still like you're watching the filmmaker kind of like find the right balance of it. And this movie feels like the quintessential Wes Anderson. Like, this is the Wes Anderson aesthetic. This is the Wes Anderson color palette. This is the Wes Anderson cinematography and framing and and staging and you know, idiosyncratic dialogue, like the rhythm of how the dialogue is delivered.
Yeah.
It's all here. And I think it works the best in this movie than maybe any other time. And again, I agree with you. Like, I don't think that his recent films are bad movies. I feel like if I'd never seen another Wes Anderson movie ever before, and I went and watched Asteroid City or The French Dispatch or The Grand Budapest Hotel, I'd still go, this is a really impressive movie. This is a really interesting movie with a lot of character. It's just that it is becoming a little caricature-ish of himself in the same way that Tim Burton kind of does this. He sort of caricaturizes his own work, and it feels like Tim Burton is doing an impression of a Tim Burton film sometimes when you watch his later work.
Yep.
And it's a bummer because these are visionary directors with a really recognizable visual style. But it is like these early films just really rock. You know, when I watched The Royal Tenenbaums, how old were you when you first saw this movie, by the way?
Oh man, I'm trying to remember the first time I saw it. I want to say that you showed it to me.
Maybe. There's a good chance.
I was probably 17 or 18 is what I want to say.
Yeah.
I think I don't, maybe older, but yeah, maybe 19.
I watched it at Kevin Martin's house, who was our film loving neighbor down the street.
Kevin was really brought us into the film. Yeah.
Yeah, Kevin was our neighbor who would always show us movies that like maybe our parents didn't want us watching or like
they were always very artistic.
Yes, Kevin.
I
think Kevin was ready for more artsy films at a younger age than we were.
He got them. He got the movies. We were like, well, where's the action? And he kind of brought us into like they can say something more than
Because I remember. You know, this movie came out in 2000, so we were like 12 years old, and I remember seeing the trailers for the movie, and at the time, what I knew about Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson is that they were funny guys.
Yeah.
And so, Ben Stiller was a funny person, and the trailer made it look like this really raucous, funny comedy. Yeah. Now, don't get me wrong, this is, to me, I think it's one of the funniest movies ever. I think it's one of the most quotable. I think it's so incredibly funny. As a 12-year-old, I think the first time I watched this, I was maybe 13 or 14. And then Kevin showed it to me at his house. He had it on DVD. And I got ready to like, I thought I was going to be watching something like Tommy Boy or, you know, that kind of comedy. And I just wasn't laughing as much as I thought I would.
Yeah.
And I didn't really get it because it was so different from anything I'd ever seen before.
Yeah.
And I didn't really like the movie until I watched it a few years later in high school. And I think that's when I started kind of evangelizing for the film and telling all my friends, you got to come watch this movie with me.
Yeah.
And now it's like when I watch it, I'm literally laughing the entire movie. Like, I think every line is funny. I think that they're just I think it's such a funny movie. But it's sort of this thing where like I've had the experience a few times over the years of showing someone The Royal Tenenbaums for the first time, and I'm dying laughing through the whole showing, and they're just kind of looking at it like, because it's just got a different comedic rhythm to it, you know?
And you kind of have, if you know what you're in for.
Yeah.
And I think that is kind of I feel like how this movie has always been.
Yeah.
Like once you know what you're in for, you're going to get it and you can really appreciate it. But if you don't know who Wes Anderson is, if you don't know his style of comedy and his style of filmmaking, it is a mystery to you. And most people probably got turned off the first time they saw this movie.
Yeah.
But when you see it again, that's when you start to appreciate everything about it.
Just the gorgeous production design, the amazing cinematography, the amazing soundtrack, like just the music. This movie uses music, and as Wes Anderson usually uses music quite well in his films. But this movie, it's like that opening sequence starting with the opening narration by Alec Baldwin of the kids. And you have this instrumental version of Hey Jude by the Beatles playing. And it awesome. Times out so perfectly to young Richie you know, letting his pet falcon Mordecai fly around the city, right? Yeah. As like the na-na-na-na-na-na part hits, you know? Yeah. And it's just like, everything is so perfectly musically timed.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like even as the kids, there's already these really, really funny lines where like, you know, Royal goes to watch a play that Margot wrote as a kid.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, what'd you think of the play, Dad? He goes, I don't really know. It's a bunch of kids dressed up as animals. What is there to like?
Well, he's like brutally honest to his like 11-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
That he's adopted like, daughter. No yeah. Adopted daughter.
And I love that.
My adopted daughter, Margot.
This is my adopted daughter, Margot Tenenbaum. You know, like they say that in the narration. He always noted that when introducing her. This is my adopted daughter, Margot.
It was very Family Guy. You know, it's kind of like a very toned down Family Guy because they would have these cutscenes. And and then it's like her birthday, right?
It's her birthday. And she's because all the kids, the thing about the Royal Tenenbaums, if you've never seen it, I mean, hopefully spoilers. You've seen it, is all the kids are geniuses. Like Richie's like an amazing athlete and he wants to be a painter. But also I love the visual storytelling that like immediately they go, Richie kept a gallery in, you know, in like the second floor, and it shows his gallery and all of his paintings are of his sister, Margot. Yeah. So right off the bat, you're like, okay, something's going on there that this kid's painting a bunch of paintings of his sister, Margot. But then Chaz, who is Ben Stiller's character, is just kind of like maybe the smartest of all the kids at an academic level.
Yeah.
He's got this, they call him, he goes, he had a preternatural understanding of international finance. And, you know, like at the age of 12, he negotiated the purchase of his father's summer home on Eagles Island, you know, and then Margot was an acclaimed playwright. But yes, at her birthday, she writes this play that her dad comes to watch. And it's a bunch of like, it's like his daughter wrote a play. Yeah. And then Chaz goes, so what'd you think of the play, Dad? And he's like, oh, what do you mean? It's just a bunch of kids running around dressed up as animals. And he goes, well, I mean, did you at least think that the characters were well-developed? And he goes, what characters? And Margot gets up and like leaves and he goes, oh, sweetie, don't be mad at me. It's just one man's opinion.
Yeah, like, oh, you shouldn't be mad. It's that really is. And then her mom has the cake and she like just stares at him the whole way down.
Yeah.
As she goes down the stair, which is,
Yeah.
It's hilarious. It's a hilarious way to open the movie.
But that I love how this is structured. I love that it's like a book that someone's writing.
And every the chapters you can see how it starts writing.
And we start with the prologue. And so the prologue is telling us about who these people were when they were kids. And then we go to, you know, chapter one, cast of characters 22 years later. Mm-hmm. And it's like I love these character intros where it says everyone, you know, it's Owen Wilson as Eli Cash and Bill Murray as Raleigh St. Clair.
Yeah.
And it says it on the screen and they're all like getting ready. And Angelica Houston as Evan, you know, or Ethelene Tenenbaum, you know, and Gene Hackman is Royal Tenenbaum, Donald Glover, and then Luke Wilson and Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah.
But it's just fantastic. Again, the music's amazing during this sequence. I love as this narration continues, as it talks about how, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow's character Margot is married to Raleigh St. Clair. I love how it shows him he's working with his patient Dudley, who's hilarious. He's working on diagnosing this new syndrome based on this patient, and he goes, all right, Dudley, make yours like mine. And it's this like collection of blocks, and he needs Dudley to mimic his blocks. And when Dudley finishes, I love what Bill Murray does, how he goes, wow, how fascinating.
Yeah.
How bizarre.
Well, and then Dudley's writing and he's talking on his tape recorder and he's like, Dudley has a complete disregard for shapes and colors. Or he says something and then he's like, he has an amazing ability to hear. And I believe he is colorblind. And Dudley's like two rooms down and he's like, I'm colorblind?
He goes, I'm not colorblind, am I? And then he goes, I'm afraid you are. And he like whispers it.
So funny.
And he's like two rooms away. He's just like, I'm afraid you are.
It was like, I guess it's just this total offbeat comedy.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like when you look at it, you're like, this is so weird. If you give into the weirdness and the strangeness of it, that's where you find the comedy.
There's so much about it that like, that's also... there's stuff that they do in this movie that is super controversial.
Yeah.
Like that they don't play it as though it's as controversial as it is.
No.
Like the fact that like Royal likes to take his favorite son, Richie, dog fighting. And it's just sort of played as a joke that Royal likes to take his son to dog fighting, but it's a thing that he does later with his grandsons. He takes them dog fighting, and it's just sort of played as like a fun moment, but it's like dog fighting's like a pretty controversial. It's really bad. But then obviously the one of the central storylines of the entire film is that Richie Tenenbaum, played by Luke Wilson, in what I think is Luke Wilson's best role is in love with his sister. And even though she's his adopted, it's still like being in love with your adopted sibling is still
weird,
strange, and not just strange, but like super controversial, like really, you know.
Yeah.
And the movie, it's not like the movie doesn't address it. They don't. They address that.
He's like, it's got to be illegal somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. There's something
weird about it. Yeah.
He goes, well, it's got to be frowned upon at least.
Yeah.
But then again, what isn't these days?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But it is the thing that I think makes these earlier Wes Anderson movies work more than these, than maybe the later ones do, is all the actors that show up in the later ones, even Tom Hanks, like Tom Hanks just did Asteroid City. They're so aware at this point of what a Wes Anderson movie is and what the style is that everyone's like doing this, the Wes Anderson style when they're in the movie. And what I love about this movie specifically is Gene Hackman's performance, because Gene Hackman is not doing the Wes Anderson thing. The Wilson brothers are, because they sort of developed the rhythm with him. And Gwyneth Paltrow is, and Bill Murray is, because he's good at it. He gets it. But Hackman's just doing Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
And but it's perfect for the movie. It's perfect.
It really is. It's kind of, you know, as you're saying that, I keep thinking about Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like the original Star Wars episodes 4, 5, and 6, the original one from the 70s. Like it was completely new to everybody, right? And you have Harrison Ford coming in and being Harrison Ford, which is what he does best. Mm-hmm. And he has a character and he makes it a character. And then George Lucas does episodes 1, 2, and 3, and it's so stiff and it's so very like biblical to a fault. And because George Lucas was so powerful then, they were trying to please him. And this is kind of how Wes Anderson is, right? Like the new ones, they're playing towards what he wants to do. Which again, I mean, it's all up to you whether you like those movies or not. But and Wes Anderson, it's not like that's bad, but it is. It does. Actors do seem to play differently in his movies because they're playing to what he wants.
Well, and I think that he has such a well-respected filmography amongst actors and filmmakers at this point in his career that and people are so aware. I mean, like if you get cast in a Wes Anderson movie, this day and age, if you're not aware of his filmography, you're going to go watch a few movies and go, oh, there's a thing going on here. There's a specific way people talk. There's a rhythm to it. And I should probably be ready to do that. And I think that there's some wisdom to that. Like I kind of like, you know, like Bruce Willis did it in Moonrise Kingdom. And I like that. Like there's these oddballs that kind of, that you wouldn't think would be a natural fit for a Wes Anderson film who have showed up over the years and done their version of it. But this was so early on in his career that Gene Hackman didn't know who he was. Like, like he personally reached out to Gene Hackman and said, I would love for you to come be in this movie. And I wrote this part for you. And famously Gene Hackman always on set was like, what are we doing? What is this? Cause it was like, such a weird movie. Yeah. And I mean, I even have like a fun little anecdote of like, I think I can say that this is one of Luke Wilson's best performances. If not, it's my favorite character he's ever played. Yeah. But I told him that to his face. Cause I was in a couple movies with Luke Wilson and I told him at a party, I said, you're in my favorite movie of all time. And you're my favorite character in the movie. And he said, what movie is it? I said, Royal Tenenbaums. And he goes, you know, that's my favorite movie I've ever been in. And I said, oh, cool. So we started talking about it. And then I said, what was it like to do that with Gene Hackman? Because I know that Gene Hackman wasn't necessarily getting what you guys were all doing. And he goes, oh yeah. He goes, I don't think Gene Hackman, because I said something to the effect of Gene Hackman's not doing the Wes Anderson thing. Yeah. Yeah. And then Luke Wilson goes, oh, well, Gene Hackman had no idea what the Wes Anderson thing is.
Yeah. Cause
he doesn't know what that, and he goes, a lot of people didn't, but like, he definitely didn't. And he gave me a little anecdote where he goes, we were performing this scene one day and Wes kept nudging us, our blocking, so that there was a photo on the wall, a painting on the wall would be framed between us symmetrically. Yeah. And he goes, and he's like, I get it because I grew up with Wes and I know what he's trying to do. Yeah. And he goes, but Hackman kept going, I'm sorry, what are you saying? And Wes Anderson would go, I just need you to step like just a hair backwards because I'm trying to get that painting behind you framed between the two of you. And Hackman would go, sorry, explain this to me again. We're doing a scene and you're looking at the painting behind me. And he'd go, and he'd be like, because like, think about it. Like Hackman's first movie was with William Friedkin, this handheld, you know, like the camera's just running and gunning. And then he's working with this young kid, like Wes Anderson was probably 24, 25 years old at this point.
Yeah.
And the kid's like, I just want to make sure I can see that painting behind you framed symmetrically between the two of you. And he's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
He's like, who cares about that? Like, what matters is the scene that I'm having with my son. That's what matters, you know. But
his style wasn't around. Like, we see it now and we get it now. And if Gene Hackman were to do a Wes Anderson movie now, he would get it. Like, because I see what you're going for. But when you don't have that as a reference. And I get why Gene Hackman was having a hard time. Like, it makes sense to me. And even Bill Murray, he told the story because Gene Hackman died. Bill Murray was talking about how Gene Hackman had a hard time on set. And he said the same thing. Like, he just didn't get it. Like, he wasn't, you know, he's like, I got it because I knew Wes and I knew what he was going for. But, you know, Gene Hackman, it was really, really hard for him on set, I guess. So.
But also for Royal to be the odd man out
is
kind of perfect for Royal. And also like it's not like you watch the movie and go, it looks like Gene Hackman doesn't know what he's doing. He's giving an amazing performance in the movie. And, you know, similar to Popeye Doyle, his character from The French Connection. One of the things about Royal Tenenbaum is that he's kind of a terrible person.
He's not a good guy. Yeah.
You know,
he definitely has more redemption in this movie than in you know, The French Connection. There's not really a redemption for him. So yeah.
In this movie, it's more that he's like comically bad.
Yeah,
you know, and Hackman, I think, plays it so. I mean, so like, you know, the kids grow up. We're following the family where they are now. Everything's sort of fallen apart. Chaz has twin boys. His wife died in a plane crash. They were all in the plane crash together. Margot is living with Riley St. Clair, you know, this kind of author and kind of psychologist. And she doesn't write plays anymore. Richie has been adrift at sea. He had a professional tennis player, but he's been sort of adrift at sea for several years. And the family's kind of a mess. And Gene Hackman is out of money and he's been living at this hotel and he gets kicked out of the hotel. And so he kind of hatches this scheme to get back into his family's lives. And there's also, it's twofold. It's like he gets kicked out of the hotel and also Henry Sherman, played by Danny Glover, proposes to Ethelene, and Royal and Ethelene have never been formally divorced. So as far as Royal's concerned, like, hey, you can't marry my wife, dude, even though they haven't been they haven't, you know, lived together for 20 years.
Yeah.
Or over 20 years. But he kind of hatches this scheme to get back into the family circle by pretending that he's dying. And there's this amazing scene where he first shows up and talks to Angelica Houston outside of the building where she's walking down the street and he goes like, hey, you know, and he pops out and talks to her and tells her that he's dying. And then she has that like beat where she goes like, what's happening? And she starts crying, you know? And I always wonder, like, I wonder if they shot coverage on this scene. And then in the edit, they just decided, you know what? Just let this thing play.
Yeah, because it's a good question. Yeah. It feels like it was meant to be all in one take.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be very interesting.
Yeah, because it's all one take and it's this lovely little scene, but also very famously is Angelica Houston was supposed to hit Hackman in the arm that was the blocking. And she was supposed to sort of slap him on the shoulder, and she claps him right on the ear. Like, she just gets him so hard on the side of his head.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see Gene Hackman be like, ah, like, you know, like he kind of like flinches, and he's like, but then there's sort of this weird rhythm between the two of them, because the scene feels so organic. And then the way he responds, he's like, Ethel,
I am
dying. You know, and then she goes, well, are you or aren't you? You know, and he's like, I am, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny because he does. Yeah. He gives it up first. He says, I'm dying. And she has that scene. And then he's like, OK, I'm not dying. And then she smacks him and he's like, OK, I am dying. Like,
it's
such a weird, like, it's, he like gives up on it, but then he realizes that's a bad idea. So he goes back into it. I think the only reason it works is because you have two amazing actors in Angelica Houston and Gene Hackman. And it just, it plays so well. They both play it really well.
The people that I'm really impressed with as far as getting the Andersonian quirk of it all in this film are like, because this was Angelica Houston's first time working with Wes.
Yeah.
And for her, she's so like settled into it. She seems like she is just like born for it. Like, I love the scene in the prologue when little Chaz walks up to Angelica Houston and goes, I need $187. And she goes, write yourself a check. And then he already has the check written out. And then she signs it. But like, her delivery is so good too. Yeah. Like when Chaz brings his boys over to her house and she goes, he goes, we got locked out of our building. And she's like, well, did you call a locksmith? And he goes, yeah. And she's like, I'm sorry, I don't understand what's going on. He's like, well, it's not safe over there. We need to install sprinklers. And she goes, well, we don't have sprinklers here either.
Well, and the funny thing goes, she's, did you pack your bags before you got locked
That's
out?
Right. Yeah. did you pack your, yeah. I also love when she goes to see Margo and she tells Margo Chaz is moving back home. And Margo goes, well, how come he's allowed to do that? And she goes, I think he's been a little depressed. And then Margo goes, so am I. And Angelica Houston goes, so are you what?
yes,
it's so good. And I also love when she goes, Raleigh's, because so there's this great scene where Angelica Houston comes and visits Margo, and Margo's in the bath, and Margo is missing a finger. I love all these little idiosyncrasies, like the things, wooden finger. Yeah, and Margo's missing a finger, and she Angelica Houston goes, Raleigh says you've been spending 6 hours a day in here soaking in the tub and watching the TV. She goes, I doubt that. Like, that's the response. I doubt that.
Yeah.
It's like, well, have you been or not? And then she goes, well, I don't think that it's safe for you to be watching the television like this. And she goes, I tie it to the radiator.
Yeah. You know? It's like, over the having electrical appliance over the bathtub.
But because Chaz gets to come home, Margo's like, well, then I'm moving home for a little while. And I love this line too, where Raleigh goes, you know, you don't love me anymore. And Margo goes, I do kind of.
It's like, she can't even commit to it. Yeah. It's so,
I do kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole, yeah.
Yeah.
That gets her to move back. And then they tell Richie, right? Richie's Luke Wilson.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And then he comes home. And then when he comes home, it was so much more interesting on this watch for me. Mm-hmm. I loved the dynamic between, first of all, I love the dynamic between the three kids and Royal, because they're all very different.
Yeah.
So Ben Stiller hates him.
Uh-huh.
Margo, I think, doesn't like him, but she's pretty indifferent the entire movie. So she's in the middle. And then Luke Wilson loves him.
Mm-hmm.
And like Royal was intentionally nicer to Luke Wilson's character than his other two kids.
So, yeah, he's a bad father played favorites. He liked Richie more than the other two kids. And growing up, he would take Richie on things that he wouldn't invite the other kids to.
Yeah.
But also, I think that Richie's such a good character because Richie knows that his dad's a bad father.
Yeah.
And he's sensitive to the fact that his siblings didn't get the same.
Exactly. Yeah, he knows because he's always very kind and very patient with Ben Stiller. Because Ben Stiller's like, I hate you. He's like, I don't hate you. I love you. Right. Yeah. And watching it this time, I really focused on that. And that's it's such an amazing way to tell the whole story, especially with Ben Stiller's character in the end, which we'll get to later. But it just kind of like, it all worked really, really well. Those three characters four because of Royal, they all intertwine so well, and they're so, but it's all very subtle, mm-hmm. you know, like in the Wes Anderson way, which is really good because you kind of have to piece it all together and figure everything out. But that, to me, this time on this watch was like, it's pretty brilliant that he made those three characters that way in regards to Royal. I do wonder though, Margot, what's your take on Margot? Because she is like, she doesn't really have, I mean, she does, you know, kind of, she has her own growth, but it's very small compared to the other two. You know,
I think that Margot has a lot of affection for Ethelene. I think that Margot knows that growing up, her only real like cheerleader and confidant was Ethelene. But here's the thing about Ethelene is Ethelene's a better parent than Royal.
Oh yeah.
But Ethelene's still kind of a workaholic, and she sort of is. We see lots of examples subtly of how Ethelene is kind of aloof and doesn't really like, you know, like when Margot says, "So am I," and she goes, "So are you what?"
Yeah, she's a little bit of an enabler. Just a little. Not horrible, but she is in a little bit. Yeah.
But I do think Margot has a lot of affection for Ethelene, but I also think Margot never really thinks of herself as a Tenenbaum. And I don't think she ever has thought of herself as.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah.
And so her sort of reconciliation with Royal is just to say, like, you know, it's all right that you never really thought of me or treated me like your daughter, because I never really thought of you as my dad.
Yeah.
And maybe we can just be all right with the, you know, the fact that like even in their reconciliation scene that the two of them have, where he takes her out for ice cream.
Yeah.
And she just goes like, "What's my middle name?" And then he goes like, "That's a trick question. You don't have a middle name." And she goes, "It's Helen." And he goes,
"Oh, that's my mother's name."
"That's my mother's name." And she goes, "I know." Like, you know, and it's like, yeah, like, you know, but she's just kind of like, "It's okay, dude. We've never had a relationship. We don't need to pretend to have a relationship."
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of better for Margot if she can be like, if everyone would allow me to just sort of divorce myself from the Tenenbaums, then I could be in a relationship with the man that I'm in love with. And you know, so.
Yeah, she does. And it is kind of, it's her journey is more. Yeah, getting realizing that she doesn't have to be all these things for everybody else to be with Richie or to find, and then she finds Richie and loves him. So,
but that's also, it's such an interesting way that. So okay, so we got to go back here a little bit, because I got to ask you, watching it this time through, there are certain scenes in this movie when I talk about how I think this movie's perfect, it's there's certain things that I'm like, I've never seen more beautiful composition in my life. The scene when Richie comes back home and waits and
I was going to talk about that. Yeah.
And the narration, Alec Baldwin says he arranged for his usual escorts from his days on the circuit to pick him up by way of the Green Line bus. As usual, she was late. And again, the use of music in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These Days, performed by Nico, starts to play. And what's your reaction when you watched that this recent time?
I mean, it really, knowing the movie.
Yeah.
Knowing that he loves her. Mm-hmm. And her coming up, I mean, it's all, you know, these slow motion and the song and the fact that he gets off, like you could see, I mean, I love it. You know, there are moments in this movie that are very, very intentional.
Yeah.
And like you said, in the composition and the framing and everything that they do. I mean, that scene has always stood out. I think it just is a beautifully shot scene, and it just kind of like it all comes together. So when you know what's going on, the fact that he loves her, and it's kind of like him coming back into, I mean, it's him realizing that he's going to come back and work through the trauma that he hasn't worked through, right? Like the reason that he broke down in the tennis match is because she got married and he couldn't have her. And I mean, but it's really interesting because this is the first moment, and it's like, it's kind of like, you know, if you like somebody and they don't like you back. Mm-hmm. When you see them, everything else kind of melts away.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything, and then you just kind of see that person and you forget the things that you shouldn't forget, right? And that's such a great representation of his inner feelings. They never say any of that.
No.
And that's kind of how I take it, is like he's just like, he's seeing her and it's like back to exactly how he was before, which is he still loved her.
That's why I feel like it's one of the most beautiful moments of visual storytelling. It's like it's like pure cinema, because it's like it's the song, it's the color, it's the composition, it's the sailors walking behind him in the background of him sitting in slow motion. It's the speed of the slow motion. Wes Anderson shoots slow motion so well.
He does,
and especially in his early films. Like, he has these sequences that are just so pretty to look at. Mm-hmm. But it's this moment where immediately you feel this well of emotion. Like, you just know, oh, this means so much, not just for him, but for both of them.
I think that
the reason why Richie's kind of a jealous guy, you know, like, he has that breakdown, which is a very funny scene when we get to see his last match that he ever played, and he had this complete meltdown. And by the way, that's Wes Anderson. Did you know that? That's the announcer that's like,
oh, is it? Oh, okay.
Wes Anderson, who's like, that's 14 unforced errors by Richie Tenenbaum.
I thought it sounded like the guy in Rushmore. Oh my goodness.
Jason Schwartzman.
I kind of thought it was him, but that makes sense. Yeah.
Anderson. Yeah.
Yeah. He's that's great.
I've never seen anything like this before.
Well, and the guy he's playing against is Gandhi, which I thought was hilarious.
Strange day here at Windswept Fields. Yeah. So Richie Tenenbaum, he's taken one shoe off in one of his socks.
I have never seen anything like this.
He goes for the ball and he just throws his racket at it and then just like sits down on the grass.
Yeah.
So good. It's like, I think he's crying. But the reason why I think that Richie has such a hard time with Margot's love life whenever she's with someone else is because I think he knows that she loves him too. And I think that there's this sort of feeling from both of them of like, this cosmic like unfairness that they were put in this situation where he's always recognized that like, she doesn't really feel like she's my sister, and she's definitely not treated by my parents like she's my sister, maybe by my mom a little bit. She and I have never, from as long as we've known each other, had a relationship that was like siblings. We've always sort of had this other feeling toward each other. And I think both of them feel kind of cheated by the situation that they were like forced to be siblings, and that robbed them of the opportunity to like be lovers. But when Margot, I think Richie has never taken any lovers. I don't think Richie's ever had girlfriends or partners. So anytime Margot goes and gets a boyfriend like, it's really hard for him because he's just like, oh, so you're okay. All right. So you're just going to go do that.
You know? Well, and it's really interesting too, when he comes back, and his Mordecai comes back or whatever. And then Raleigh St. Clair is like, I think Margot is cheating on me. And he like freaks out.
I love the way that this stage is. Yeah.
He punches the window out.
Yeah.
He's like, what are we going to do? We're going to find the guy.
Yeah.
And it is so interesting because he still believes that like, she doesn't love him and he still has a chance.
Well, and it's also like, it's so funny too, because Richie's so subdued. Like Richie's whole character is like, he almost acts like he's on Valium all the time.
Yeah.
Like, it just feels like because Richie has deprived himself of love his entire life, like whatever spark he had, whatever energy he had when he was playing professional tennis, all of that went away when Margot married Raleigh and when he realized like he'd lost her for good. And he just seems numb. Like, he just kind of goes through life very subdued. So his energy is very soft. He's very soft spoken. He's very quiet. And as Raleigh St. Clair's, you know, confiding in Richie, he's not even moving. He's just silent. And then he just goes, and just punches through the glass, and it's like out of nowhere. And then and Raleigh's like, oh, it's like, oh, okay. You're like, you really care about this a lot.
He's like, oh, calm down.
Yeah. Another character that we haven't talked about yet is Eli Cash, and
Owen Wilson
as Eli is so funny in this movie.
Oh yeah. He's just like, he is such a strange character. But he is hilarious.
Well, so here's an interesting thing. So if Margot has never wanted to be a Tenenbaum, she was sort of forced against her will to be a Tenenbaum. Eli always wanted to be a Tenenbaum. And Margo and Eli have this little affair outside, you know, and there's this little trade-off where, like, Eli wanted nothing more growing up than to be one of the Tenenbaum children. And Margo wanted nothing more growing up than just to be able to be some girl that could date Richie, you know, and not Richie's sister. And, I love the weird guy that Eli grows up to be, that he's this like drug addict who wears, you know, suede jackets with fringe and like a cowboy hat everywhere he goes. And I love when he's talking to Margo on the phone and he goes, "Well, what do you mean by saying I'm especially not a genius? You think that I'm especially not a genius?" And then he just goes, "Wow, you didn't even have to think about it, did you?"
Yeah, all he wants is her approval and he never gets it.
Yeah, it's so good. And but also I love that it cuts back to Margo and we see her end of the conversation. She's in the tub and she goes, "Well, I just don't use that word lightly." And I like that because later on, Royal says to Margo, he goes, "You know, you used to be a genius." And she goes, "No, I didn't." And he says, "Well, anyway, that's what they said about you." You know?
Yeah, and, that's true. Mm-hmm. I didn't catch that. That's really cool. Yeah. And I love the fact Owen Wilson is everything he does. Just like, it seems like his only payoff is at the end.
Yeah.
Maybe not the only one, but the fact that he's like, when Richie comes in to see him and their whole conversation is like nonsensical. And he's like, "I don't know, man, I'm on mescaline." He's like, "Did you say you're on mescaline?" He's like, "Yeah, man." So.
Yes, I did. Very much so.
Yeah. Such a
it's so funny because like his apartment's crazy too. Like the art on the walls with these guys with no shirts on, with like, their faces painted and they're riding ATVs. It's like, what is this?
What do you have there?
But also I love the conversation that they have because Eli Cash has told Margo about a letter that Richie sent him where he said, "I'm in love with Margo." And then so Richie goes, "Hey, did you tell Margo about that letter that I sent to you?" And he goes, "Yes, I did." And then he goes, "How come she repeated that, I wonder?" And he goes, "I'd ask you the same question." And then Eli goes, "Rightly so." It's so good. Just like, rightly so.
See, that's the dialogue again. It's not played as funny.
No, no.
That's why, like,
but that's why I'm like, every exchange I think is so perfect worded.
Yeah.
"How come she repeated that, I wonder? I'd ask you the same question." "Rightly so."
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like, that's so good.
It's not played for laughs, but that's what makes it so funny.
Yeah. And I'm just going, "Did you say you're on mescaline?" "I did, very much so indeed."
<It's> like, oh man. He is so strange. You know, this is the other person we haven't talked to as much about, but and I noticed him a lot more in this one, but Danny Glover.
Oh,
Danny Glover is so good in this movie.
Oh, he's so good. He's so good in this movie. I love the way he proposes to.
Oh,
to Ethelene. Apropos restructuring for I-9 versus, you know, I think it would be advantageous for your tax status to legally be established as single. And then she's like, "What are you saying, Henry? Ethelene, would you marry me? I love you. Did you already know that?" "No, I didn't." It's like such a weird proposal. She's just goes, "No, I didn't."
Well, she's like, "This isn't about taxes, is it?" He's like, "No, I don't know why I framed it that way." Yeah. Anyway, he is like so funny. Again, he got it. Like he got the Wes Anderson. Yep.
He's also like so sweet. Like Henry Sherman is such a, like, of all the characters in this movie, Richie and Henry Sherman are probably the sweetest characters.
Well, and again, like, coming, I guess Ben Stiller's story really stood out to me as well.
Yep.
I mean, the other ones are still great, but the fact when he comes in at the end and they're about to get married and he's like, "Oh, you have a son?" And he's like, "Yeah, it's from my first wife." He's like, "Oh, what does he say? You're divorced?" He's like, "No, I'm a widower." He says, "Oh yeah, I'm a widower too." And he says, "I know." What is the exchange? He just says, he says,
"I know you are, Chaz."
Yeah. And he like puts his hand on his shoulder and it's such like a sweet moment again that like, they're not over. You kind of miss it if you're not really paying attention. But it's done so well that it, like, it's, again, the visual side of it, they're playing it back, but yeah, you get so much out of it. And I think it's done perfectly.
The Chaz and Royal arc is the most, like, emotionally, yeah, like, heartstring pulling arc of the entire movie.
Yeah.
Because that scene, I'm a widower too. I know you are, Chaz. Yeah. That's a beautiful exchange. Yeah. But the exchange that kills me every single time, and it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen Ben Stiller do in a movie, is at the end of the movie, Ethelene and Henry are getting married. Eli shows up, and again, I love Eli driving down the street, face in full war paint, and he goes, "Here I come." And then he crashes the car into their house and kills their dog, unfortunately, yeah, which yeah, is very sad.
It is sad.
And it's Buckley. Also, like, it's important because Buckley survived the plane crash with Chaz and the boys.
Exactly.
So Chaz's whole thing is that, like, A, he obviously didn't have a good relationship with his father growing up. B, he feels estranged from the rest of his family. C, his wife is dead, and he feels like the only thing that he has in the world to hang on to are his boys. And he has this very overbearing relationship with his boys.
Yeah.
And I do love the exchange too, just going back a little bit, when Royal is getting kicked out of the house after they find out that he's been faking his stomach cancer. And he says to Chaz, "Go easy on those boys. I don't want this to happen to you." You know, just basically like, hey, you know, I don't want you to, like,
yeah,
have your sons grow up and resent you. Yeah. It's not fun. Even though Royal knows, like, he definitely earned, you know, Chaz's resentment. But there's this lovely moment where Royal goes and gets a Dalmatian for Chaz, which is also poignant because Chaz bred Dalmatian mice growing up. So he gets him a Dalmatian, and he goes, "Hey, I got this for you and the boys," because their dog just died. And Chaz bends down, and he just looks at, I'm going to cry talking about it. He looks at Gene Hackman and he says, "We've had a really rough year, Dad." And he goes, "I know, you know," and it's like, and it's, oh, it's just like, it's such a, like, it's such a sweet moment. It's such a, it's such a beautiful moment. And it's like one of the, like that, cause Chaz is, like, so rough the entire movie. He's so angry. Yeah. He's so angry.
Well, and even before that, when that happens, the fact that Gene Hackman saved his sons, he pulled him out of the way, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's like, that's when Ben Stiller has his breakdown.
Yeah.
He goes and he chases Eli Cash, and he's like, he's freaking out. And like, you know, he pushes the priest down the stairs or whatever.
Yeah. This is also like the staging of this chase scene is so funny. Oh, it's so funny.
Funny. Yeah. Like, he grabs him and then, like, what is the exchange? They're running around, and then he realizes, that's the moment when he realizes, you know, he lays down on the ground and he's like, "I have a problem," you know, like, and that whole scene again is like, as you watch it more and more, you're like, wow, this is really pretty. It's pretty amazing. Pretty well crafted for his.
Eli goes, did I kill the dog? And he goes, yeah. And then he goes, "Oh, I need help." And then Chaz goes, "Me too." Yeah,
That's right.
So do I. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
And it really, like, I love, and I'm jumping forward a little bit. Because that, again, this arc really stood out to me this time. And I love the fact that after everything's all said and done, Royal and his two grandchildren, they're on the dump truck.
Yep.
And then Ben Stiller pops out and he's like having fun. And then they, you know, Alec Baldwin just says Royal died of a heart attack, and Chaz was the only one that was there with him.
Yep.
And the scene is so quick because everything has already happened. Everybody has already had their moment.
Yeah, this is our epilogue. This is the epilogue.
Yep. Yeah. And it's such an interesting way that he does that because they've all had their growth and they've all had their moments. And then in the end, he gives you this last little piece that Royal did die of a heart attack, and Chaz was the only one who was there. And I mean, it's just a quick scene that they're in the ambulance, and Chaz is like, you can tell that he's really worried.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he's already had his growth, but he's still there, like, genuinely worried about his father.
Yeah.
And it's such an interesting way to do that. And this time I was like, wow, that's really, like, it's really powerful that it just adds to it. Like the fact that they really did change, like it's really interesting. I love it.
I really like Royal's growth from like being such a self-centered, you know, jerk the entire movie to, you know, like I love when they're kicking him out of the house, when they find out that he's been lying about the cancer, which also like Pagoda, great character. Pagoda's so good.
Pagoda.
When Pagoda stabs him with the Swiss Army, you son of a bitch, and stabs him. And then he goes, that's the last time you stick a knife in me, you hear?
And he helps him up and takes him to the hospital.
Yeah. But also I love how he goes, you know, the way that we met was he took me to the hospital after I'd been stabbed at a bazaar in Calcutta. And the kids go, who stabbed you? And he goes, he did. He goes, oh, he was an assassin and there was a price on my head. So it's like Pagoda stabbed him and then took him to a hospital. And that's how they met. It's
and
so
then he
funny.
Does it again.
Yeah, it's so funny. But but I also love when Royal stands up and he goes, you know, I just want to say that the last 6 days hanging out with all of you has been maybe the best 6 days of my entire life. And I love the way that they word this in the screenplay. Alec Baldwin comes in as the narrator and says, immediately after saying this, Royal realized it was true.
Yeah.
And so it's like, he says it, you know, kind of instinctively as like a, because he's just like a guy who lies and he's just like saying it as a lie or what he thinks is a lie. But then immediately after saying it, he's like, actually, it's sort of like that moment in Liar Liar where Jim Carrey goes, I love my son. And then goes, I love my son.
Yeah.
Oh, this truth stuff's pretty cool. You know, like,
and
after that, it's cool because Royal's like willing to humble himself to become a bellboy at like the hotel that he was living at. And he's doing it all so that he can like have money to get to do things the proper way. And I love, so we have to talk about one more thing before we get to our wrap up here, which is, there's a couple scenes in this movie that I genuinely think are some of the most beautiful scenes I've ever seen in any movie. Yeah. We already talked about one of them, which is Margot coming and picking up Richie from the bus stop. The one we haven't talked about is there's this really great montage of Margot's love life, you know, that this private investigator shows Rally and Richie. And after, Rally realizing that he's been cheated on for years by Margot, and Richie realizing that it wasn't just Rally, that it was all these guys.
Yeah.
Over the years, she was with all these different men. Mm-hmm. And Richie, who's been pretty numb for the last however many years, goes back to Rally's place. Or maybe they're back at
I think he's back at the Tenenbaum place.
The Tenenbaum house.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing this as a teenager too. I remember when Kevin showed me this and being like, whoa, this scene's really intense.
This scene sticks out more than any other scene. This is what always comes back to my mind when I think of this movie.
Yeah. And it's Richie goes into the bathroom and attempts suicide in a pretty grisly way.
Yeah.
But it's shot, the cinematography in the scene, because the film grain changes and it becomes this, like, there's this blue filter on the, and we've got this Elliott Smith song playing Needle in the Hay. And it's just like, everything is so stylistically perfect. And then down to like this weird idiosyncrasy of, you know, you see the kind of this montage of Luke Wilson shaving his beard off and cutting his hair off. And he never takes the sunglasses off. He leaves the sunglasses on the whole time. And then he takes the sunglasses off and looks in the mirror and says, I'm going to kill myself tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking as a kid, like, why did he say tomorrow? And then he did it.
Yeah.
But I think that that's one of those things about the way that this script works in this movie, that there's these weird idiosyncrasies where maybe like Richie in that moment is like, I'll do it tomorrow. And then he's like, or I'll just do it right now, you know?
Yeah.
And,
And the scene, I mean, you know that something is weird.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think one of the big I don't know, I could be totally off on this, but you know, it's really blue. Mm-hmm. The scene is all very blue, and the opposite, and it's more like a cyan, right? The opposite of cyan is red.
Mm.
And when you overblow somebody with, when you fill somebody's eyes with color, it makes the opposite color, when it is brought in and introduced, it makes it more vivid, right? So when he's doing all this, he shaves, and he only shaves this part of his face. He says, I'm going to kill myself tomorrow. And then it shows a camera angle from above, and you just see blood coming down his wrists.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming down. And so when the blood actually comes on, it's really vivid. And yeah. It really catches your eye. I mean, it's pretty amazing how they shoot all this. And I mean,
also this little like flash of him with the full hair too, yeah. Like where he's like fully shaved. And then there's like a flash on the screen of like him with the full hair and the long hair and then his wrists in the,
yeah.
And it's like, I just love the way it's edited and the way it's, yeah.
And to the music, everything. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is not, you know, this is where it comes in. It's a dramedy, right? Mm-hmm. This is kind of where the real drama comes in. They don't ever treat this as funny.
No.
Because it is really serious.
But it gets funny pretty quick because Dudley makes it funny. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Dudley comes in and Dudley's the one who finds him.
Yeah.
But I, you know, like they don't, it's again, the controversy of this movie that they bring in. And again, they're not trying to say anything bad. You know, we all know that suicide is a horrible thing. And if anybody is struggling, you know, always reach out to your friends. Right. And, but it's an extremely impactful scene that, it doesn't shy away from it. It doesn't really make it. It doesn't make it a comedy. It doesn't make it. It also doesn't linger on it too long. Yeah. So it's really impactful in the sense that, like, wow, that's pretty. Like, it's very impactful, and it makes you kind of think about it in a little bit different way because they move on so quickly. And I think it's kind of a good way to do that, you know, because it doesn't glamorize it. It doesn't, you know, villainize him or make him look bad in any way. So it's done very, very well and very effectively.
But yeah, like the whole scene is, it's very serious. It's not played, like you said, not played for laughs at all. We see this kind of montage of like the family, know, like Ben Stiller, who's had this kind of tumultuous relationship with his brother, like jumping in a car and they're driving to the air, you know, they're driving to the hospital and he's got this look on his face, like this concerned look on his face. We see, you know, Ethleen, rushing to the hospital. We see Margot running down the hallway of the hospital and Dudley comes out and he's got blood all over his shirt. And this is where like we cut through the tension because Margot says, "Where is he?" And Dudley looks at her and goes, "Who?" it's like, who else would it be? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
But, but also I love this little weird idiosyncrasy of like Ben Stiller goes, "Why'd you try to kill yourself?" And he goes, "I wrote a suicide note." And he goes, When'd you write it? And he goes, just after I regained consciousness. So it's like after he did it and regained consciousness, he wrote down the suicide note. Yeah. And then he goes, can we read it? And he goes, no. And he goes, could you paraphrase it for us? I don't think so. Yeah. Is it dark? Of course it's dark. It's a suicide
note. Yeah.
Yeah. I also, oh my gosh, there's so much about this. There's so much about this movie I love so much. Yeah. I love this scene with Rally because Rally now knows that not only has Margot been cheating on him for years, but she's a smoker. She's been a smoker for 22 years. And he goes, "May I have a cigarette?" And she goes, "What?" He goes, "Shall I repeat the question?" And then she pulls her cigarettes out. And I love Bill Murray's physical acting because she goes, "You're not a smoker." And he's like, "I know." But then he like awkwardly grabs the cigarette and he like doesn't know how to hold a cigarette. And he's like,
yeah.
He like holds it really weird in this weird way.
Yeah.
And then he's like, well, and he like walks away, you know, but like it's such a like great little bit of physical comedy.
Yeah.
One other weird moment that with Donald Glover that I like, this is also lovely too.
Danny Glover.
Danny Glover. When Danny Glover comes in, there's two things here. When he comes in after Richie's suicide and says, "How can I help?" And there's that really sweet moment where he pulls his glasses on and his tie is tucked into his glasses. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's when Ethleen really realizes that she's in love with this man and she's going to marry this man.
Yeah.
And he's just such a sweetheart. But I also love when Royal and Ethel are walking through the park talking and Danny Glover pops out from behind a tree and he's just holding two bags of groceries. Because I love the detail of like he's just got two full arms of grocery bags and he just pops out from behind a tree like
it's like
I just love stuff like that about Wes Anderson movies where there's just like a detail of something that's like we don't need to tell you why he has grocery bags in his arms. You can just
it implies more story.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
I love. You know.
Yeah. I I love that stuff. And yeah,
it's really, and he does it. He does it probably better than anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And this, you know, after the suicide, you know, yeah, this scene with Richie and Margo in the tent, I think is really well written and well acted.
Yeah.
And beautiful, but it's weird. Again, like you said, the movie does not shy away from these controversial things. It goes headlong into them and it doesn't apologize for them. It's like these two characters are in love with each other and they're in a situation where that's kind of impossible. So what do we do about that? But then they have this moment and it's weird because you find yourself as an audience. You're not like, ew, at least I've never been in all the times that I've watched this movie. I've never been like, I'm always just kind of like, good for them. Like, and it's weird because in real life, I don't think I would feel that way, but
yeah, I know it's still a little strange for me. Like, yeah, but I get it. Like they're, it all works out, yeah, but it is still a little strange, but you know, the people, so they do a good job of getting you to understand the characters, which is really, really helpful. But yeah, the scene in the tent, I mean, they're, and this is one of Gwyneth Paltrow's better performances, I think, too, because she plays it so deadpan, mm-hmm, and she does it really, really well. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it's unsatisfying, but the fact that she says, I think we just have to pretend for a little while that we're not in love with each other still.
Yeah, I think we're just going to have to be secretly in love with each other.
Yes. Yeah, that's what she said. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, but that's what they've been doing their whole lives.
Yeah.
And just kind of this thing of like, I think we have no choice but to be secretly in love with each other.
But the thing that makes it more, I mean, again, like I said, it's not unsatisfying. They've never said that to each other.
I know.
So the fact that they're actually putting it into words, like we are going to be secretly in love with each other, I think that's what makes Richie fine. Like, okay, yeah, we both agree. Like we're both on the same page because they've never said it to each other.
Right. Now, is your feeling at the end of this film, when they're at Royal's funeral and they're all walking away and Richie sort of with Margot, is your feeling that like they've begun a relationship, or do you think that they just go on being kind of brother and sister who are secretly in love?
You know, I think whether they're secretly in love, whether they're out, like everybody, they're secretly in love. They both know it and they do have that relationship.
Yeah.
I guess I haven't really thought much more past that.
Yeah.
My guess is, yeah, they're together, but that's kind of, I think the point is that they both know it and they will eventually be together in some way.
Yeah. There's a lot of great writing for the two of them. I love when they're in the cemetery earlier in the film, and they're Richie and Margo are walking and talking, and she goes, you know, Eli told me about that letter that you wrote him. And then Richie stops and kind of looks at her and goes, you dropped those cigarettes back there. And she goes, those aren't mine. And he goes, well, they just fell out of your pocket. And it's just sort of like this kind of thing of like, okay, well, you know, my secret, I know yours, you know?
Yeah.
But like great writing. And I also love when she first shows up to pick him up and she goes, stand up straight, let me get a good look at you.
Yeah.
And he stands up and then she goes, what's so funny? And he just shrugs and she goes, well, it's good to see you too. Yeah. And like, there's such great writing for the two. Yeah.
And it was nominated for best original screenplay, which is very well deserved.
Yeah, absolutely. What a strong piece of writing from Owen Wilson and Wes Anderson.
Really? Because I love the subtext of everything. Mm-hmm. And there's so much subtext in this movie, as we've been talking about.
Yeah.
But even that scene that you just talked about, both all the scenes, it's very smart, clever writing.
Yeah, I could go on and on and on and on about every single thing that I like about this movie. It's what, like I said, maybe my favorite movie of all time. But yeah, the great Gene Hackman, he is fantastic in this film and he's got a great character arc, and whether he enjoyed the process of making it or not, I'm glad he did make it. And I'm glad that, you know,
I am too, because he plays it so perfectly.
Yeah,
because he acts so nonchalant. Again, the scene when he tells his daughter that the play she wrote wasn't good.
Yeah.
The way he plays that is so earnest, like it wasn't really good, like and he has no idea why his daughter would be upset with that.
Like, oh, and sweetie, I mean, that's just one man's opinion.
Yeah, and I don't like his character, but I know we all know people who are like that. And it's like, yeah. Really? You don't understand why that would be a bad thing for you to say.
Oh, I and love
he plays it so well.
I love when he shows up to like the hospital after Richie's suicide attempt, and he comes in. He has to get Smitty to cover Dusty to cover for him at the hotel, and he runs in his bellhop uniform, and he goes, Richie Tenenbaum. And she goes, visiting hours are over, and he goes, what's it say there? They don't want me. You know, like, you're seeing the growth of like outside he was with Pagoda, and he goes, well, we could shimmy up that guardrail and we could kind of, yeah. You know, like he's like trying to break into the hospital. But I also love when Pagoda just goes, there he is. and Richie's just standing at the bus, and he just waves at him like, and just gets on the bus. Yeah. But also then later when they're trying to take Eli to rehab, and he goes like, yeah, I'll go get my things, you know, and he walks out and they're all talking. And then Pagoda goes, there he goes. And they look out the window and Eli's like climbed down the fire escape. And he's so good.
Oh, man.
I also love the Eli Cash scene when he's being interviewed on TV, and he's like, well, you know, Wildcat was sort of written in an obsolete vernacular. Wildcat. And then he just, I'm gonna go.
Why did Owen Wilson want to play that part? He plays it great. But like, he wrote the movie.
Yeah. Why did he not want to be Richie?
Yeah. Why did he not want to be Richie?
Yeah.
And I mean, Luke, again, I agree. I think this is Luke Wilson's best performance. He's amazing in this movie.
Yeah.
But like, why did Owen Wilson want to give that to his brother? I love it because it all worked out, but it's so interesting.
He didn't want to be Chaz, you know, like, you could see it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, but why did he choose that character? It'd be interesting to find out. There's probably something out there, but.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure that there's some,
Yeah.
I also, one more exchange that just for Gene Hackman too.
Yeah.
Cause I think that this is a great piece of writing too. And I'm going to have to quote it, but it's at the wedding when they're going to get, you know, the boys who went over the fence, Chaz and Eli went over the fence in their big chase scene. And Danny Glover and Gene Hackman are walking, you know, together. Yeah. And Gene Hackman's like, you know, I want to apologize to you, Henry. You're like, you're a good man. And, you know, I'm sorry that I've been kind of an asshole. And then and then Danny Glover goes, well, I don't think of you as an asshole, Royal. I've always just kind of thought of you as a son of a bitch. And then Royal goes, oh, well, I appreciate that. So good. Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
That is really funny.
Yeah.
That's great. The few scenes that they have together, they both do really well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they're
great actors.
Their fight scene.
Yeah.
You trying to steal my woman?
Yes.
What? Yeah.
He's like so kind at first, and then he switches.
Yeah.
Danny Glover. Cause I mean, Royal's being horrible.
Yeah.
He's Coltrane? Trying to get to him. Yeah. Yeah.
What?
He's saying all these racially.
Did you call me Coltrane?
Things. Yeah.
No. But if I did. You wouldn't be able to do anything about it.
And then Danny Glover, like, he switches, which is great.
The way that they fight with like their pauses that they take of like, hey, no, you.
Well, then so she good. Comes in and Royal totally backs up. Oh, it's nothing going on. There's nothing going on.
Yeah.
That's great.
Did you call me Coltrane?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So oh, good. Oh, man. Okay. Well, yeah. Royal Tenenbaums. I think it's an all-time great. It's definitely one of, if not the best film Wes Anderson's ever made, in a very strong career, at least in my humble opinion. Let's do some scores. Royal Tenenbaums, Kramer, how do you score this movie technically?
Technically, I'm going to give this movie a 9. I mean, it just... They're definitely like, I could say, obviously you love this movie and I love this movie. Sure. I don't love it as much as you.
Yeah.
I still think it's amazing though. There's just a couple things. The pacing sometimes is a little slow. Mm-hmm. And that's why I dock it a little bit, but I mean the cinematography, the music choice, the writing, everything else is pretty top notch. So it's a little bit more of a nitpick, but it also, The couple things that, and the fact that it still is weird that he loves his sister. I mean, that's just,
yeah, so funny. Yeah.
But yeah, it is very well acted. It all makes sense. So anyway, 9, technically, it's a pretty amazing movie.
Yeah, I'm obviously at a 10. Like, I'm this is the movie where, and I totally get those things of people watching the movie and bumping on one of the main storylines is an incest storyline. It's like, sort of.
But I
think that the world is so well structured and the characters are so well realized, both in the writing aspect and in the performance aspect. And then you combine that with just everything that makes a not just a good Wes Anderson movie, but a good movie production design, just the detail of it, the music and the cinematography. When I watch it, I just feel like it's one of the prettiest, most well-constructed things I've ever seen. So obviously 10 out of 10 for me. The ending of this film, how do you like the ending?
The ending, as we talked about, I mean, it really is great how they wrap everything up. So I gave it a 9. I think it's very emotionally satisfying.
Yeah.
And it's also very subtle. And I really love it because it fits very well for the movie.
Yeah, I give this movie a 10 out of 10 ending. There's this thing that Wes Anderson used to do for his first several movies that he stopped doing. It was like this trademark of his where as the movie would end, it would go into slow motion and everyone would like walk out slow motion. So I love this Van Morrison song plays and the whole family walks out of away from the cemetery and they drop the flowers down on Royal's grave and it shows his epitaph, you know, the epitaph that says like he died, you know, courageously saving his family from a sinking battleship. I love that. But then like as the last person walks out, they close the gate behind them and it says Tenenbaum on it. And I just feel like it's like, oh, perfect. Just especially with the way that like the Royal and Chaz arc resolves in such a satisfying way. Yeah. And there's, 10 out of 10.
Yeah. I think it's concerned.
Rewatchability for you?
Rewatchability, I put it an 8. Mm-hmm. It can, you know, I mean, Wes Anderson movies, they're very funny. You know what you're getting into, but sometimes it's a hard watch, especially with some of the things that they go through in this one. But
yeah,
still, 8 is still pretty high because it's a pretty great movie. If you get the chance to watch it and you can sit down and watch and appreciate it, you're going to get some amazing stuff out of it.
Definitely. And I'm at a 10 still because I watch this movie at least once a year. And every time I watch it, I feel like I loved it. I love it more than I did the previous time. Yeah. And I don't know how that it keeps doing that to me. It keeps like every time I watch it, I think like, oh, maybe this will be the time that I go like, that's enough viewings. But I just keep. So it's maybe the most rewatchable movie for me in my personal pantheon of movies. Cultural significance of this film. What do you think?
Oh, man, I don't know if I should give it. I should probably give it. Well, I put it at an 8. Because this really put Wes Anderson on the map and I think though, the fact that he stuck with this was the beginning of his really, like everybody really got the Wes Anderson style and then he just kind of kept going with it. So I think, you know, altogether his films are very impactful as a whole. And I could probably put it higher, but I mean, this one, he still wasn't totally into his style. So I gave it an 8. I don't know. Maybe I should have given it.
Yeah, higher. I put this one. I get that. And I put this one at a 9 for kind of the same reason where it's just like Wes Anderson has become a thing that whether people like the movies or don't like the movies, they know what the movies look like.
Exactly.
It's an oft parodied style. Like there's SNL skits making fun of it. And there are so many different skits and movies that are sort of aping this style. And I think that a lot of times when they do parody Wes Anderson, they're drawing a lot from this specific film.
Yeah.
Like the whole thing of like Richie wearing like the headband and like, you know, like when people dress in a Wes Anderson aesthetic, they'll wear like a tracksuit or it's a lot from this film. So I think that this film is in many ways kind of the quintessential like icon, visually iconic Wes Anderson aesthetic and style. So yeah. I'd give it a 9. And then just subjective score.
My subjective score is a 9. Yeah. It's like, I appreciate it so much. It's so great. Great writing. It is a really, really genuinely well-made film, and it's really, really good.
My subjective score, first, if this is a Wonder podcast first, is an 11 out of 10. It's the most that I could. I had to give it more. I was like, okay. I have to give it more than 10 out of 10, 11 out of 10 for me. Nice. I don't know what it is about this movie that's so thoroughly, because you're right, there are things thematically about it that I should bump on ethically, or I should, you know, and I don't know why it just, it's not like I don't have like a, I'm not like secretly like, ooh, I really think that brothers and sisters should be in love. I just kind of think there's something about it where I'm like, how do you create something like that? How do you create something so unique, such a unique world of characters, and pull it off so beautifully? And
I think it is, it's very much an appreciation for somebody's craft that is so different than your own.
Yeah.
And I say that to myself as well, right? Like, as we talked about at the beginning, like I do not see stories this way.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Like, we all see stories in a different way, but the fact that he sees them that way and just loving the style of somebody and loving the way that they do something that speaks to you on a level that you can't explain, that you wish you could be, right? There's so many things. There's so many filmmakers that I look at, I'm like, I just wish I could be that way. Which we all have to find our own style. You know, all of our filmmakers have things that they wish they could be too, but it's so amazing to see him know exactly what his voice is. And this is really the movie where it's coming out, and he's really getting into his groove. And it's just something that, you know, like we obviously have an appreciation for it. It's something you appreciate it's just great to watch when you find you see that someone has found their voice. And they're doing exactly what they want to do, how they want to do it, which is great.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a great assessment. My light just went out, and I think that means that it's time for the end of the show. My light already went down like to like half light, and then it went out.
Which it's, I a think means,
it's a sign. It's a sign that that we need to wrap it up. RIP to the great Gene Hackman.
Yes.
This was an episode in tribute of a solid film career. And let us know what you think of let us know if you think we're totally wrong about the French Connection, and let us know what you think about the Royal Tenenbaums, and we'll see you on the next one. Thanks so much for hanging out. Like, share, subscribe, comment, all that stuff. Yeah.
Bye-bye.